This week on Making Contact.
There is no safe dose of radiation, and scientific analysis that I've done says there can't be.
For more than two decades, the United States tested nuclear weapons in southern Nevada. A total of 928 nuclear detonations that affected the people working at and living nearby the test site.
I was critical of the public information program, and rightfully so, because I felt that it not only was negligent, it was deceptive.
The stories of the American nuclear experiment, in the words of the people who worked at the Nevada test site and those who lived under the mushroom cloud. This is part two of Dirty Harry, when the American dream became a nightmare. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Since the early 1950s, the United States has tested nuclear weapons over a section of desert called Frenchman Flat, about 90 miles northwest of Las Vegas. People working at and living nearby the test site were severely affected by the radioactive fallout. Since the 1990s, independent producer Klaus Andreasen interviewed test site workers, scientists, legal scholars, as well as the people living downwind from the Nevada test site. Today we'll hear the second and last part of his documentary, Dirty Harry, When the American Dream Became a Nightmare. Host John Brupe will be our guide as we hear the stories about the early years of testing and how it affected people working at and living nearby the test site.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this program to bring you important news. Word has just been received from the Atomic Energy Commission that due to a change in wind direction, the residue from this morning's atomic detonation is drifting in the direction of St. George. It is suggested that everyone remain indoors for 1 hour or until further notice. There is no danger.
The test site employed thousands of people. Among the telecommunication workers there was a young man we'll call Mike Wilcox. Largely disabled now, he sits in his recliner in his Las Vegas home, attached to an oxygen system. In the 1950s and 60s, he installed phone lines to the individual test sites.
You'd actually start at 4 o'clock in the afternoon after all day work, and then you'd go on shot coverage, and then they'd shoot it off, and I'd go out there as soon as they let me and see if my van was all right, and usually it was.
What did they warn you about in terms of safety? What did they tell you about in terms of exposure or safety?
Don't watch it go off.
And that was it?
Yeah.
How long after one of these shots was fired were you allowed to go back to check your equipment near the shot location?
Well, a lot of times I would see it go off and I'd wait a long time, maybe an hour, hour and a half, and I'd go out there and get ready to go in, and nobody would be there to stop me, so I'd go in. And I remember I was in this one van one time way out there, and I checked it all out and called in and told them what I was doing and called my people, and then I went out to the door and was looking out, and I saw this security coming towards me with his lights flashing and all that. And he came whipping up, skidded to a stop, and said, "You got to get out of here. It hasn't collapsed yet." And I followed him out of there. And that was as close as I ever come to getting mangled.
Other than telling you to turn your back when the blast happened, what other kind of safety precautions did they give you?
I had a badge that had a radio frequency detector on it. It was actually a piece of film, and they had it covered half with lead, and if it got through the lead, you were really radiated. I never did have an overdose. A lot of my buddies did, and they'd throw away their badge, and which was terrible because they actually radiated, and it never was recorded. That was a common thing out there, and I never did. I always turn it in every month, and they'd measure it and see I was within the safe area.
Did these guys then ultimately get sick or anything? Did you know about
them? One of my good buddies named Bob Bowman, he lost his voice box.
Your presumption was that was because of exposure?
Yeah, he was a repairman, and he'd go right out in there and overexpose himself down the line.
In the early days, in atmospheric testing days, people were exposed to radiation. The general public was exposed to radiation from the clouds that were transported off of the test site. No one was ever deliberately exposed or injured, but we were living on the state of the art, and we did things as best we could, and we were criticized over time because we didn't do better. We did what we could.
The date was May, 1953. The place, Nevada. The big gun is ready to prove its atomic punch as one phase of Operation Upshot Knothole in the Nevada desert.
The fallout from the nuclear tests in Nevada did not only affect people and animals directly. The radioactive particles fell on the ground and were consumed by grazing farm animals. And in the 1950s, every other family had their own backyard cow from which they got their milk. Janet Gordon was a big milk drinker.
Oh, I liked milk. When I was growing up, I could have lived on milk. In fact, I did a lot of the time. We had our own cows, but I would drink sometimes as much as a gallon of milk a day.
And after the tests, did you have any effects from that?
Well, you know, I didn't know that I was having effects at the time, but I ended up with a very strange rash, particularly on my legs. It's almost like hives. But it wasn't all the time. And I went to the doctor, and they finally determined that it was probably milk that was causing it, which is probably why I have thyroid problems now, because the iodine-131, that is its favorite path, is through milk.
It would be another 20 years until a researcher at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City was able to prove the connection between thyroid problems and the iodine from the fallout. His name is Dr. Joseph Lyon.
I can remember when the research assistant came in and showed me the data the first time. I said, well, you've obviously made an error. You must have reversed the control group because there's a positive association. And we had to have made an error. And we went back and redid that study twice before it was published. We refused to believe that there was anything going on there. We know now that St. George had 50% of their milk in the 1950s coming from backyard cows. About half the people there were getting their milk out of a private cow, and the time from the cow eats till the time you drink the milk is about 24 hours. You get a very high dose.
Dr. Joseph Lyon continued to do research into the effects of the nuclear weapons tests. He was also interested in the occurrence of leukemia in the downwind area. And in his report, he concluded it could be due to fallout or to some other unexplained factor. But the more he looked into it and was able to work out some reasonable estimates of the dose to the people living in the area, as well as how many had moved in and out of the area, the association between fallout and leukemia became even stronger.
Everything we predicted about what radiation would do from known other exposures was there. And it was at that point that I had to say, I think there is something going on. I don't think this is just a statistical fluke. And instead of saying there was a threefold excess, we said there was about a sevenfold excess.
There was a turtle by the name of Bert, and Bert the turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. He'd hide his head and tail and four little feet. He'd duck and cover. He hid beneath his little shell until the coast was clear. Then one by one his head and tail and legs would reappear. By acting calm and cool he proved he was a hero too. For finding safety is the bravest, wisest thing to do. And now his little friends are just like Bert, and every turtle is very alert. When danger threatens them, they never get hurt. They know just what to do. They duck and cover.
The sandy wastes at Yucca Flat, Nevada, a new series of atomic explosions are set off. Tanks are among the obsolete pieces of Army equipment being tested in the exercises called Operation Teapot.
By the 1950s, it was well known that radiation-exposed miners in Eastern Europe had suffered higher than normal incidences of lung cancer. It was also reported that children in the area had been born with physical deformities. The Atomic Energy Commission knew the damage that was being done from nuclear weapons tests by the radioactive fallout and had the policy of suppressing this information, according to Nobel laureate Linus Pauling.
I was able to calculate that millions of unborn children would be born with defects because of the bomb tests that had already been carried out by 1958, and that millions of human beings would die of cancer earlier than they would have died otherwise because of these radioactive substances.
Troy Wade arrived at the Nevada test site in 1958. He started out as a mining supervisor, but later became test manager.
I always felt that the safety programs at the test site were very, very good, and that people put a lot of effort into assuring that exposures were as low as possible. I'm always felt, as I made the transition from a sort of a worker to a manager, that we paid a lot of attention to personnel safety.
Is your sense that the U.S. government did all they could to make these people whole or to help them out as best they could, do you have any regrets about how the U.S. government treated these folks?
Well, I think there's several different answers to your question about how the folks were treated. I mean, and there were atmospheric tests with off-site radiation doses that were secret until people saw the cloud coming, and the Atomic Energy Commission in those days had a very strict secrecy policy, and I think in retrospect there was information withheld that wouldn't have made any difference in the outcome, but would have alerted people to exactly what was happening.
You're listening to part two of Dirty Harry, When the American Dream Became a Nightmare. Coming up next. Troy Wade, former test manager at the Nevada test site. He believes that nuclear testing might be resumed in Nevada, something which upsets many people, including downwinder Janet Gordon.
In a country of democracy, citizens should not be expendable.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. We now return to the last part of Dirty Harry, When the American Dream Became a Nightmare, a documentary about the effects of 40 years of nuclear weapons testing in Southern Nevada, hosted by John Bupre.
Civil defense is common sense. Hi, this is Tony Bennett. Make sure you're prepared if a nuclear attack ever comes.
We live in the greatest country in the world, in a very free and open society. And I think the fact that we had a nuclear deterrent made that kind of society possible. And some people paid a larger price for that freedom than others did, than I did, for example. And only the individuals can judge if it was worth it. I certainly believe it was, is and was.
The printed information the Atomic Energy Commission handed out to people living in the downwind area in the 1950s stated, "To our knowledge, no one outside the test site has been hurt in 6 years of testing." Or as Janet Gordon puts it, the AEC didn't want us to be concerned.
They send out little booklets that tell us exactly what was going on and how safe we were. I have one of them. On one page it says the best thing that we can do to protect ourselves from fallout is not to worry about it.
When the invisible cloud had passed, the total amount of radiation deposited on St. George was far from hazardous. The Atomic Energy Commission doesn't take chances on safety.
But while the Atomic Energy Commission tried to reassure people that the fallout from the tests was well within safety limits, many scientists disagreed, arguing that there is no safe dose of radiation. Professor Emeritus John Goffman is one of them. Once a member of the Manhattan Project, he became an avid critic of nuclear weapons testing and a well-known expert on low-level radiation exposure.
There is no safe dose of radiation, and scientific analysis that I've done says there can't be because of a very simple thing. We have the evidence that radiation has produced cancer in 9 separate human studies at doses that are so low that there can't be a lower dose. You cannot say for certain that this child or this man has a leukemia caused by radiation, but we can say a different thing. We can say if they had this much radiation, and you make an estimate of how much they had, then you can say that 30% of his disease must be assigned to radiation, or if it's a leukemia where the amount of radiation it takes to double the frequency of leukemia is very low, doesn't take much radiation to double the spontaneous leukemia frequency, we can say 80% of this person's leukemia must be assigned to radiation. That is what you can do.
The scientific argument also made its way into the courtroom. The federal government was never found liable for harming people working on or living near the test site, with one exception. In a landmark decision handed down on May 10, 1984, the U.S. District Court in Salt Lake City found in favor of 10 out of 24 plaintiffs who suffered from various illnesses, mainly cancer.
Today, in a landmark federal court decision, Judge Bruce Jenkins ruled the federal government was negligent in conducting above-ground nuclear tests in the 1950s and 60s. It was a major victory for the American people living downwind of the Nevada test site.
Judge Jenkins ruled fallout from the test caused cancer, that American citizens died due to the failure of the government to warn them of the dangers of radioactive fallout.
The ruling is vindication for the people of Southern Utah. A federal judge said today what the people of Southern Utah have been saying for a long time, that in the interest of national security, the government sacrificed some of the people of the West.
There is nothing wrong telling the American people the truth, Judge Bruce Jenkins said at the end of his 215-page opinion. The government had vastly superior knowledge about the risks of radiation exposure, he added, and therefore had a stringent duty of care to minimize such hazards.
The information supplied to what, for want of a better word, we could call industrial sites, testing the instrumentalities that were available, the Geiger counters, the film strips, the periodic physical examination, the periodic blood examination. Now, you contrast that kind of care with the care given to the public in general, and you not only found an absence of that, but you found affirmative action on the part of the United States in producing films and pamphlets which reassured the populace in general as to the lack of danger involved in fallout. I was critical of the public information program, and rightfully so, because I felt that it not only was negligent, it was deceptive.
The government's main argument in all legal cases was its discretionary function, which simply means that it cannot be held liable for harm caused by a policy decision. In essence, the king can do no wrong. But Judge Jenkins believes there is a distinction between the people who make the decision and the people who carry out such a decision.
The act is designed to make sure that those who carry out policy, in contrast to make policy, conduct themselves in a fashion that their actions are reasonable, are not negligent. And one needs to distinguish between policy decisions and operational decisions. The policy that's made and the manner in which the policy is carried out.
While the downwinders celebrated the outcome of the Allen case, former test manager Troy Wade disagrees with the judge's finding.
I don't believe that officials at the test site ever deliberately were negligent. I think there were certainly cause and effect of things that had adverse effects on people on the site and off the site, but I don't believe I've never seen in my 40 years, 50 years in the business, anyone ever make a decision that deliberately was intended to harm someone? Remember, this is a test program. And when you do test programs, whether you're testing nuclear weapons or automobiles, things can go wrong. And they did.
The Jenkins ruling was so well written. It was such a victory for us. And we had so much optimism that we would be able to make a difference.
But Janet Gordon's optimism would turn into heartbreak and resignation. 3 years after the original ruling in the Allen case, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver reversed Judge Jenkins' ruling based on that discretionary function.
Friends, this is Bob Hope. If an atom bomb were to hit your home city, would you know what to do? Remember, one explosion of an atom bomb could kill 75,000 and maim 100,000. This is only one kind of a disaster which could strike. In addition to many forms of enemy action, there are the dangers of fire, flood, earthquake, and traffic. Knowing what to do before, during, and after a disaster can improve your chances of survival.
In 1990, Congress passed the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, recognizing that the lives and health of uranium miners, test site workers, and people who lived downwind were involuntarily subject to increased risk of injury and disease. Congress also apologized on behalf of the nation. With the act, people with certain cancers and other serious diseases were promised compensation. As of August 31, 2006, over 14,000 downwinders have received about $50,000 each. Janet Gordon was one of the downwinders who testified before Congress, and she says the Compensation Act was a shallow victory, but a victory just the same.
We made compromises up to the yin-yang, and it breaks my heart when somebody I know who suffered because of that radiation fallout, then they're turned down flat and have no recourse. It does break my heart. And it's not right. And we need to keep working on it until they find a better solution. But in the meantime, you also have the plus of the acknowledgement that they did do harm to us, because they weren't acknowledging it before that. It was watered way down. But there was still an acknowledgement and a small apology.
First, Chairman Khrushchev, Prime Minister McMillan, and I have agreed that high-level discussions will shortly begin in Moscow, looking towards early agreement on a comprehensive test ban treaty.
Following the comprehensive test ban treaty, the nuclear weapons tests were halted at the Nevada test site in 1992. The treaty was signed by President Clinton, but has yet to be ratified by Congress. But anyone who passes by the test site here will notice that it is far from abandoned. Article 9 of the treaty states that any nation, in exercising its national sovereignty, have the right to withdraw from the treaty if it decides extraordinary events have jeopardized its supreme interests. As the U.S. nuclear arsenal is aging, and many of the nuclear weapons will be retired, it is possible, says former test manager Troy Wade, that testing in the Nevada desert will be resumed.
I still believe that there's a high probability that this country is going to have to do or want to do a nuclear test. Now, notice what I said there, a nuclear test, not a group of nuclear tests or a test series. I don't think anybody believes that there will ever be a need, thank goodness, to do numbers of tests again. But I think it's entirely possible that there might have to be one done to fix a problem. I think a less likely probability, but not zero, is that there will be enough of a need for a different kind of a deterrent that we would have to do a test on a new design.
The stage is set in Nevada for the 35th nuclear explosion in the history of America's atomic progress. In the test area, at varying distances from ground zero, cars of recent make are distributed to act as blast guinea pigs with mannequins for occupants. Two replicas of average American homes are located, one 3/4 of a mile and the other 1.25 miles from the blast center with their dummy occupant.
The radioactive clouds from the total of 928 tests conducted at the Nevada test site didn't only affect the immediate area. There are fallout records from such far-off places as New York, Missouri, Nebraska, Montana, and Idaho, to mention only a few. It affected the lives of thousands of people, downwinder Janet Gordon says, and of the people who lived and worked in the area, some of whom were interviewed for this program, many have since passed away.
People like Kerm Bullock and Gloria Gregerson and Dorothy Fox and Elmer Pickett. Oh, I miss Elmer Pickett so much. And these people are all gone. I think about how privileged I've been to have known and worked with these people and how sad I am that they're no longer here with us. And most of them have died premature deaths. Some of them certainly were not caused by the radiation, but they had effects from the radiation, every one. It made me so angry. It just about burned me up from the inside. And to be right honest with you, that anger has never completely gone away. All I have to do is think about what really happened and how cavalier they were towards our lives and the lives of my family and my descendants. And I just can get it fanned right up again and get ready to rumble some more, because it really, really makes me furious. In a country of democracy, citizens should not be expendable, or at least they should be given a choice.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You just listened to the final part of Dirty Harry, When the American Dream Became a Nightmare, written and produced by Klaus Andreasen and hosted by John Bupre. And it's worth mentioning, the interviews you've heard are from the 1990s, but the same issues exist today. Native American groups, anti-nuclear activists, and other downwinders are fighting U.S. governmental plans to continue non-nuclear tests at the Nevada test site. Many scientists say these explosions would spread radioactive particles and create future generations of downwinders. You can find out more about these issues at our website at radioproject.org. Special thanks to KNPR for production assistance. Support for this documentary came in part from the PRX Reversioning Project. Thanks to Dan Turner and the Monday Morning Breakfast Crew. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For a CD copy of program number 4207, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736, or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Puck Lowe associate producer, Samson Rainey and Joaquin Palomino interns, and I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.